From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Just over a month ago, the Department of Agriculture announced that it will allow American farmers to plant a genetically engineered version of alfalfa. Organic food producers oppose the decision, some more fiercely than others. As Dan Charles reports, the news also sparked an angry debate among organic advocates about what's most important in the organic label.
Looking out over the rolling pastures of this farm near the Chesapeake Bay in eastern Maryland, the world of organic milk production seems peaceful.
From here, we can see everywhere we graze. See those posts on this side of that school bus?
Yeah.
That's the end of our pasture.
Dudley McHenry manages this farm for Horizon, one of the biggest organic milk producers in the country.
And then up here in this corner, those gates, that's actually the farthest point our milk cows will walk for pasture.
They will, at least in summertime, but it's February, so they're eating inside.
We feed corn silage, triticale, clover, alfalfa, ground corn, roasted soybeans.
But there's a tiny bit of something in the feed that these cows eat that's provoking a bitter division among people who all describe themselves as defenders of organic farming. The provocation is GMOs, genetically modified organisms. That's the popular term for plants with genes that were inserted in the laboratory. Organic farmers aren't allowed to plant GMO seeds, but most conventional corn in America is genetically modified, and corn, among all grains, is perhaps the most promiscuous cross-pollinator. So those genes often migrate into organic fields via wind-borne pollen that lands on the tassels of organic corn. As a result, grain traders say organic corn in the U.S. typically contains anywhere from 0.5% to 2% GMOs. It's been that way for the last 10 years or so. Now, does that matter? Maybe not. Tom Spohn, Horizon's director of dairy operations, says it doesn't keep Horizon from calling its milk organic.
We just make certain that we're meeting the letter of the organic regs to the T.
Those regulations say if a farmer plants non-GMO seed and uses organic methods, the harvest is organic, even if a few stray genes blow in. But in the past few years, antibiotic activists like Ronnie Cummins from the Organic Consumers Association have been calling on organic businesses to fight back against GMO contamination.
If you're not willing to sue the person who pollutes the organic crop, and, you know, really undermines organic integrity, and we're not standing up for you, you know. It's like, you've got to do the right thing.
Cummins and other anti-GMO groups are aiming their attack at a crop called alfalfa, because that's the GMO crop that the government approved most recently. Alfalfa is widely used as feed for horses and dairy cows. When this crop is grown for animal feed, it's actually much less likely to cross-pollinate than corn. But activists say even a little bit of contamination would be a disaster for organic dairy farmers. And that claim is echoed by some organic executives. Christine Bushway is executive director of the Organic Trade Association.
The threat to the alfalfa supply is very real, and the concern for our dairy producers is a huge one.
And Bushway even says if pollen from GMO alfalfa fertilizes alfalfa in organic hay fields,
you can't at that point sell it as organic.
This is a dangerous claim for the country's biggest organic trade association to make, because if that claim were true, if cross-pollination actually turned organic crops non-organic, there wouldn't be much organic corn left in the country. Charles Benbrook, chief scientist for the Organic Center, says this anti-GMO campaign is a risky thing for the organic industry. It could undermine the trust that more and more consumers have in organic food.
It would be a shame for the momentum behind the growth in the organic livestock industry to be siphoned off or diverted because of 0.1% contamination in a source of animal feed.
In fact, he says, if you insist on milk and eggs from animals that eat absolutely no GMO genes, you'll have to get that food from Europe.
And that's hardly a welcome solution for people that see in the organic food industry the best hope for positive change and innovation in the U.S. food system.
Some organic executives are worried that this infighting will lead to unrealistic demands by consumers. George Seaman, for instance, who's CEO of Organic Valley, one of the country's biggest organic food companies.
You know, there's reality and there's perception.
And perception is consumers are saying they don't want any pollution in organic products, and whether that's realistic or not is another matter. But for sure, consumer perception is a real concern.
Siemens cited a survey in which 77% of organic consumers said they would stop buying organic food if it contained GMOs. Pamela Ronald, a plant biologist at the University of California, Davis, says those consumers are losing track of what's most important. Ronald has a foot on both sides of the biotech wars. She works with genetically engineered plants in the laboratory, and she's married to a longtime organic farmer. She and her husband together wrote the book Tomorrow's Table.
What's really important is, can we reduce use of insecticides? Can we foster soil fertility? Can we feed the poor and malnourished?
Those are the most important goals of organic farming, she says, and they're much more important than avoiding laboratory-spliced genes. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Fashion Week started in Paris today, and already there's high drama. British designer John Galliano, the top talent of fashion house Christian Dior, was fired. As Eleanor Beardsley reports, he was ousted for making a series of bizarre anti-Semitic remarks, some of which were caught on video.
50-year-old designer John Galliano was suspended by Christian Dior last Friday after a couple filed charges against him with the police, saying Galliano had insulted them using racist and anti-Semitic remarks. What turned that suspension into today's full-fledged dismissal was this. Video of another altercation was posted on the website of the British newspaper The Sun. It shows Galliano using foul language to insult bar patrons. He calls them ugly, and then in a slurred voice he says,
"People like you would be dead today. Your mothers, your forefathers would be gassed and
dead. Oh my God.
I love Hitler," he said, "and people like you would be dead, and your mothers, your forefathers would all be gassed." The video stunned the fashion industry just as the Paris catwalks heat up for the fall ready-to-wear collections. Jessica Michaud is online style editor at the Herald Tribune newspaper.
It's absolutely a shock to the world of fashion. John Galliano is one of the icons of the fashion industry. He has defined Dior for the last 10 years, really transformed it, made it what it is today.
Galliano was questioned by Paris police for 5 hours Monday about the incident over the weekend. Under French law, it is a crime to make anti-Semitic remarks. Since then, another woman has filed charges against Galliano for hurling anti-Semitic insults at her in the same Paris bar last October. Galliano's lawyer denied the charges but hasn't commented on the video. One of Christian Dior's directors condemned Galliano's behavior, saying the company had no tolerance for racism and anti-Semitism. Called fashion's bad boy for his flamboyant and provocative style, the extravagantly dressed Galliano usually parades down the catwalks himself. He may have done that for the last time, says fashion critic Michaud.
The fashion world really is forgiving. It's very common in the industry for there to be problems with alcohol, but the idea of saying, you know, I love Hitler, that is not something that you can recover from.
For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Frank DeFord has golf on his mind this week. It's a sport he says is still dominated by one person.
Tiger Woods is a phenomenon, only no, not the golf phenomenon that he once was. He is now an instrument of curiosity, the likes of which both the public and the media have never dealt with in any sport ever. Even though Woods' recent performance suggests he's only just another golfer now, when he plays, until he is undeniably out of contention, he remains the story. Tiger shoots three over. Tiger closes gap. Tiger trails by 8 strokes. What's his name wins as Tiger finishes 14th. And so on. In a way, he holds golf hostage. Oh, sure, dyed-in-the-wool golfers follow their whole sport closely, but the fringe fans, the type that really determines a sport's popularity, are fixated on Tiger. This week, he's not playing, so golf doesn't exist. Ladies and gentlemen, golf will officially resume again next Thursday when Mr. Woods tees off at the Doral. It was understandable that he was the absolute focal point when he was the greatest golfer maybe ever. We always follow the superstars, and he was super-duper. But what is so bizarre is that the interest in Woods remains so high. Phil Mickelson, Graham McDowell, Martin Keimer, they barely exist. It's almost as if we cannot believe that Woods can be diminished. I'm convinced that this unusual intrigue is caused by the fact that we, and maybe he too, can't be sure why he's no longer great. Is it because of the notorious sex scandal, what that did to his reputation, his psyche, his confidence, and ultimately his game? Or is he diminished just like other human athletes simply because he's older, no different from Roger Federer in tennis, Tim Duncan in basketball? I think for many people, even those who detest him personally, what sustains the mystery is the belief that he was so fantastic that age simply cannot be the issue, that Tiger Woods will get his mind straight and be the lord of the links once more. And yes, of course, he could win again. Woods is 35 now, and it is not unusual for players to even win a major when they're older than that. But it tends to be a catch lightning in a bottle kind of thing. Sure, older golfers can win one big one, but they don't win very often. But Tiger must be different. Certainly, isn't he? Maybe. You know what he reminds me of? The Broadway musical Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. It sells out to the curious, even though the critics hate it, and it's always a tease, always a work in progress. Maybe Spidey will find itself, but maybe it'll always be not quite there. We watch Tiger Woods with the same almost morbid fascination, afraid to look away, because if we do, we'll miss it if he miraculously returns to greatness, as if age doesn't matter with majesty, and what changed his life was all just a bump in the road.
The comments of Frank Tufort, who joins us each Wednesday. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is testifying before Congress this week. He's delivering the Fed's semi-annual report about the state of the economy. We think that he is optimistic, but always when a Fed chairman speaks, it helps to find an interpreter to translate his words into English.
Which is why we brought in David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, so what are the reasons for Bernanke's cautious optimism, if in fact that's what it is?
No, I think that's what it is. He's basically saying the economy is better, but not good. He pointed out that, for instance, the bad news is we lost nearly 9 million private sector jobs during the recession, and we've only got 1 million of them back, but we are slowly adding jobs. So although he says until we see stronger job growth, we can't consider the recovery, in his words, to be truly established, the Fed is now predicting that we'll see unemployment down below 8% by the end of next year.
By the end of next year, 2012. So still
That's
a very slow decline in unemployment here.
Absolutely. So he's pleased that the economy's growing, but he says it's not growing fast enough.
Now, at the same time, a lot of people are worried about whether the crisis in Libya, which is sparking an increase in oil prices, which were already going up, could have an effect on the economy. What's Bernanke think?
Right. That's probably the biggest change in the world economy since he was last grilled by Congress. And what he basically says is that he expects, at worst, a modest and temporary increase in inflation. Higher gasoline prices, he says, can reduce the amount of money that consumers have to spend on other things. That's bad for the economy. But they can also raise people's expectations of inflation, which is an early warning sign of inflation. So far, though, he sounds pretty calm. He says that the rise in oil prices we've seen so far don't pose what he called a significant risk to their forecast that inflation is actually so low that it's too low for their own comfort.
Is there anything in what you just said that would suggest that the Fed might have to be thinking about raising interest rates to restrain inflation?
No, the Fed is in this kind of watchful waiting mode. They keep saying that, you know, we're not on autopilot, but we don't expect anything in monetary policy to change for months and months and months. He says they won't raise interest rates and they won't start selling some of this huge hoard of securities that they have until they're convinced that the recovery is what he called self-sustaining and inflation has risen closer to their long-term goal of about 2%.
David, for some reason, I'm thinking of a U.S. diplomat more than a century ago who said that the job of a diplomat sometimes in complicated situations was the most stubborn inaction. I wonder if that's what Bernanke is holding to now, stubborn inaction.
No, I think that's right. And I think what you saw in the in the testimony yesterday is a number of members of the Senate Banking Committee are kind of incredulous, and they say, surely you're going to start fighting inflation, aren't you, Mr. Bernanke? After all, oil prices are up. And he's telling him, no, I'm not going to let inflation get out of control, but it isn't anywhere near that yet, so I'm staying on the sideline.
You're talking about questioning before the Senate. How might things be different as he goes before the House of Representatives?
Well, the House committee is much bigger, and it has a much more diverse set of critics of the Fed, from Ron Paul, the libertarian from Texas on the right, and Barney Frank, the liberal from Massachusetts on the left. So he'll give the same speech to them, but then the question and answering, which is the real theater of a congressional hearing, is likely to be somewhat more lively and at times bizarre. But at the moment, he seems to be able to withstand this thing and enjoy like defending what the Fed's doing, because the economy's getting better, and that's always easier for a Fed chairman.
Well, David, enjoy the testimony today.
Thank you.
David Wessel is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here.
Meanwhile, we're turning now to healthcare and the latest political maneuverings over how last year's healthcare overhaul should be implemented. Yesterday at the White House, President Obama announced that he supports changing the law to allow states to move sooner to develop their own plans to expand coverage. Mr. Obama says states would still have to meet the goals of the federal law. But as long as they do that, he says he's willing for governors to come up with their own strategies as soon as 2014. That's 3 years earlier than the law currently provides. That's an idea that was originally proposed by two senators, Republican Scott Brown and Democrat Ron Wyden. They introduced this past fall what's known as the Empowering States to Innovate Act. Senator Wyden says it should help calm objections from both the right and the left.
Progressive folks say, why should I be required to purchase health coverage from monopolistic, rip-off, insurance, companies? And conservative folks say, any kind of individual mandate violates, my freedom. Here's a chance for folks on either conservative or the progressive side of the political spectrum to show they have better ideas. If they meet what constitutes real coverage, which, of course, is the litmus test for reform, they'd have a chance to try their approach.
That's Senator Ron Wyden, and we'd love to hear from you. If you're opposed to the health law, would this amendment make a difference in how you feel? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Well, we've got NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner here in the studio with us. Thanks, and welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure.
So explain for us, I'm not sure I understand exactly what this act would do. It means states could opt out of the federal law, but they would have to come up with something better instead.
That's right. It means they could take all the federal money that's going for this law, or pretty much all the federal money, and there's a lot of federal money that's going to the states in this law. And rather than do what the federal law says, which is set up these insurance exchanges and have most employers be required to provide insurance and expand Medicaid, they could take that big lump of money and say, we want to do it our own way. And in fact, Vermont would like to set up what's called a single-payer plan. They're already trying to move in that direction, where they would just have the government do it all and have everybody in Vermont have government-provided health insurance. And they're moving along those lines. So they're one of the states that really wants to do this. They jumped right out when the president said he endorsed this yesterday. A couple of other states want to do that. But if a conservative state wanted to do something else, something more market-oriented, they could do it too. Of course, the big caveat: you have to cover just as many people. You can't add to the deficit. Those are two big, big caveats. So you got to take the exact amount of money. You have to cover as many people. Other than that, you can do whatever you want to do.
And to be clear, states would be allowed to pursue their own plans under the law as it's currently written, but this amendment would allow them to do it a few years sooner.
That's right.
Okay. When President Obama endorsed the act, he was at a meeting of the governors at the White House yesterday. What kind of response did he get from the governors who were assembled?
Stony silence, in fact. And, I went back to the governor's meeting yesterday afternoon to get some reaction. And, I've been asking governors about this. I've been pursuing this story, for the last couple of months, and asking every governor I come upon about this. And the Democratic governors are, fine. If people people want to opt out, that's great. They mostly are happy with the law the way it is. Republican governors keep saying, we want to know more about it. We want to know more about it. We want to know more about it. So they don't quite want to buy into it yet. Most of them haven't said, though, that they hate the idea. Now, I should add that Orrin Hatch, who's the top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, was on the NewsHour last night, and he absolutely just ripped it up on
side. He hates the idea.
Can't stand it, says it doesn't mean anything, that no state would actually be able to do this. They wouldn't be able to meet those requirements of covering that many people, you know, with only that amount of money, and that we're basically all headed for government-run health care anyway. So Republicans in Congress really don't like it, but these Republican governors haven't quite ruled it out yet.
They would like to see bigger concessions from the White House in terms of the health care.
I should point out, the reason the president did this yesterday is what the Republican governors really want is changes in Medicaid. One of the things this law calls for is big expansions to the Medicaid program. This is the shared federal-state Medicaid program for the poor. The federal government is going to pay most of the cost of adding about 16 million people to Medicaid, but the states are still very upset about that. Medicaid costs right now are hurting them. Between now and 2014, when these new Medicaid people come on, states are not allowed to curb their enrollment. That's hurting their budgets right now. They want some more freedom between now and then. So this was sort of the president trying to, you know, do a little sleight of hand, say, well, here, I could give you this kind of flexibility. That's not what the states are looking for. States are looking for Medicaid flexibility, and that's not what the president was offering them.
Is this likely to have any impact on the way we're seeing this play out in the courts? We've heard from several judges who have ruled the health care law or aspects of it unconstitutional. Is this likely to change any minds in the judiciary?
Probably not. This was actually asked. There was a phone call yesterday with some senior administration officials, and somebody actually asked about that, because one of the things that a state could do is, in fact, opt out of this requirement for people to have insurance, and that Senator Wyden pointed that out, too. But I think that the consensus is that that requirement for people to have insurance is going to stand or fall on its own weight with or without allowing states to opt out.
So there's still broader issues that need to work their way through the courts.
It certainly looks that way.
Okay. As you look ahead, are you able to gauge, as you report on this, Julie, how flexible the White House is prepared to be? I mean, this is the president's signature domestic policy achievement of his tenure so far. How flexible are they prepared to be to make sure that in some version or another it stands?
It is. You know, and the president has said, you know, all the way along, he's willing to make changes around the edges. The House this week is doing another bill that would repeal one of the financing mechanisms for this law it's a paperwork requirement for small businesses that turned out to be heroically unpopular. And I think everybody agreed it was a bad idea. They're going to make it go away. Again, didn't have anything to do with healthcare per se. It had to do with how you were funding the bill. Eventually, the House and Senate disagree about how to make up the $19 billion shortfall it would cause, but eventually that's going to be made to go away. The president says he just doesn't want to relitigate the core issues. But, you know, a bill this large always gets what are called technical corrections. And sometimes technical corrections for a bill like this will be pretty substantive and pretty major. So there's nothing unusual about making, you know, mid-course corrections to something like this. So you would expect to see, even if this had passed with big bipartisan support, a year in, 2 years in, some pretty big changes as people look at stuff and think, well, that wasn't very well thought out, or that's not really going to work the way we thought it would. So you would always expect to see legislative changes to it. So the idea that the president would be endorsing some legislative changes around the edges, or even a little bit more around the edges, not that surprising. It's just everybody's putting more into it because this has all been so wrought with controversy.
And what specifically are we looking for next in terms of the next couple of markers coming up down the road where that may give us some indication of how this is playing out?
Well, certainly the House is still, you know, knowing that its vote to repeal the entire law isn't going anywhere in the Senate. The House is still trying to defund the law. The 7-month continuing funding resolution for the government that they passed would defund the law in various ways. I think there were 7 different amendments. That's still on the table, although they're now voting on this 2-week extension. So there's another couple of weeks to get through. So that's still working through. As I mentioned, there's some of these smaller issues to tinker around the edges. This particular amendment, this bill that would change the date, unclear whether the House would go for that, because, you know, the Republican House still wants to make the whole thing go away. So it's hard to know if they'll come around and make some of these smaller changes that presumably Republicans and Democrats could agree on.
What about just how this is playing out for ordinary Americans watching this, trying to follow the politics of all this? Do you see any shift in terms of its popularity out there in the country and how people are perceiving whether this is working for them or not so far?
Well, there was a rather remarkable poll that came out last week that found that almost half of the public either thinks or is unsure that this law has already been repealed.
Wow.
So it was about 20% thought that with the House vote it had been repealed, which it has not, I should add, and another 25% were unsure. So the public's still really, really, really confused about this law. About 14% thought that they'd been helped, but there were a significant number of people who think they've already been hurt by the law, most of those because they've seen health care costs go up. Of course, this law has not done anything yet. Any of the savings that it's supposed to produce don't happen for several more years. So the costs that have gone up are largely not attributable to the law. But, of course, people don't see that. They see the law passed, their costs have gone up, one must have caused the other. So there's still a lot of confusion, a lot of misunderstanding that's going on in the public.
And I'm sure ongoing efforts by the administration to try to sell to people how this is working, that it actually is still in place, and how it's likely to play out as they see it to improve.
Today we've got a group of six organizations that are starting yet another effort to try to help people understand what this law does for them. I mean, there's a lot of support, organizational support, but again, you've got a lot of political opposition. So there's still that, you know, continuing clash of people saying, wow, this is really terrific. No, this is really awful. So no wonder the public is confused.
Are you able to chart any shift or any change in terms of how flexible Republicans and Democrats are on this issue? There's been a lot of talk about a new era of civility in the Capitol. Do you see any of that, or is anybody backing down at all?
Not when it comes to health law. I mean, certainly you've got, you know, these House Republicans who came in, many of them ran on this issue they ran on repealing the health law. That was one of their signature issues. You know, you see in some of these state legislatures, some of these governors saying, you know, or some of these people saying, well, these governors didn't run on this issue or that issue or the other issue. A lot of these people in the House ran on repealing this health law.
All right, we have a quick call that we have time to squeeze in. This is Glenn on the line from Rogers, Arkansas. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Two things. I think the secrecy surrounding Nancy Pelosi's passing of this bill has misled the American people. Secondly, with dancing around the edges by the president, I think that they do not attack the core issue, one of the core issues, of liability insurance costs, which are horrendous and driving up the cost of medical care. Do you care to comment on that?
Julie, you want to tackle that?
Well, yeah, on the latter issue, liability costs, this is mostly medical malpractice. There have been an awful lot of studies. It's a big issue for doctors. It is, unfortunately, it's sort of like foreign aid in the budget. It's an issue. It's not a huge issue. If you got rid of all of medical malpractice and even all of defensive medicine, it wouldn't make that much of a dent in rising health care costs. It's an important issue. It's one of those issues that both Republicans and Democrats say they want to address, but it wouldn't stop the core problem of health inflation. You know, as to the secrecy, this goes on and on. It's a very complicated bill. Again, all sort of big bills are written to some extent behind closed doors. Yes, the president did not keep his promise that this would be written, you know, in front of the cameras on C-SPAN. On the other hand, you know, no major legislation is.
All right. Ron, thanks. Glenn, I beg your pardon. Glenn, thanks very much for the call.
It's just a matter of this driving medical professionals out of that career.
Thank you, Glenn. We appreciate the call. And thank you to you, Julie. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We're talking here on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we've been talking here to Julie Rovner, NPR's health correspondent. And there's a link to Julie's piece about the latest developments in the healthcare law debate at our website. You can go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Think of Ernest Hemingway. You think of that brilliant writer with a larger-than-life macho personality. He's less familiar to us as a young man in love. In the 20s, Hemingway shared his life as a poor, unknown writer in Paris with a pretty but unglamorous Midwesterner named Hadley Richardson. As NPR's Lynn Neary tells us, their story has been fictionalized in a new novel, The Paris Wife.
Hadley Richardson appears here and there in Hemingway's book about his Paris years, A Movable Feast. These glimpses of Hemingway's first wife caught the eye of writer Paula MacLean. They made her curious about this woman that Hemingway seemed to idealize in the memoir he wrote toward the end of his life.
And this one line really stood out to me when I was rereading it, and it's, you know, I wished I had died before I ever loved anyone but her.
I loved her, and I loved no one else, and we had a lovely magic time while we were alone. I worked well, and we made great trips, and I thought we were invulnerable again.
MacLean says she didn't want to write another biography about Richardson. She wanted to go deeper, to imagine what Richardson's life in Paris was like, what she was thinking as she moved through the circle of artists and intellectuals the young couple met there. MacLean was also keenly aware that Hemingway himself had written of those years in A Movable Feast, and she didn't want to feel she was competing with him.
I think the way that it occurred to me at the time, and perhaps I was fooling myself, but, was that I was in conversation with that book and that I was inserting my version of Hadley into that time and talking about their places and their experiences from her point of view and giving her an opportunity to kind of step into the light for a moment, out of the fringes of literary history.
Richardson was 28 when a friend introduced her to Hemingway. She was a gifted musician but had spent most of her 20s taking care of her sick mother. The handsome, charming Hemingway opened up a whole new world for her. When he told her he wanted to move to Paris so he could write full-time, MacLean says she was eager to go.
How romantic, right? She wanted to be part of it. She was ready. I mean, she often said that when she hooked her star to Ernest's, that she exploded into life. And yet, I think there was some playing catch-up that needed to be done. Think about how intimidating it must have been to be in these salons, you know, to be at the foot of Gertrude Stein or Ezra Pound, these incredibly opinionated tastemakers.
Richardson wasn't always taken seriously by these greats. She was just the wife. Still, the Hemingways were seen as something of a golden couple, a fresh, unspoiled contrast to the more sophisticated and perhaps more cynical people who surrounded them. Paris was theirs for the taking.
We called Paris the great good place then, and it was. We invented it, after all. We made it with our longing and cigarettes and rum St. James. We made it with smoke and smart and savage conversation, and we dared anyone to say it wasn't ours. Together, we made everything, and then we busted it apart again.
Things began to unravel. Richardson lost a briefcase that contained 4 years of Hemingway's work. MacLean says Hemingway never really forgave her for that. It was symbolic of how different they were. Hemingway was single-minded about his writing. Richardson was the homemaker and mother, taking care of their child, who they nicknamed Bumby. Finally, Hemingway began having an affair with one of Richardson's friends, a glamorous young journalist named Pauline Pfeiffer.
During that time that she was pursuing Ernest and never losing her position, never sort of losing this pretense that she was Hadley's best friend at the same time, she was sending letters to them both. And the letters to Ernest were, you know, as one might imagine, letters to a lover. And the letters to Hadley were sort of eerily asking for approval.
The marriage fell apart after a disastrous summer when the three of them vacationed together on the Riviera in the company of the wealthy and popular Sarah and Gerald Murphy, who loved to entertain talented artists and writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway. Many years later, Richardson, who by then had been happily remarried for many years, told an interviewer how glad she was when the marriage finally ended.
It was the greatest relief. I didn't expect it would be,
yeah.
But it was. His Ernest was a terrific responsibility. And when he was not happy, when he was leading a double life and everything, it was just awfully hard.
But Richardson also told the interviewer she still cared for Hemingway and thought he was a great man. For his part, MacLean says, Hemingway seemed to regret what happened to their marriage.
And I think he did believe that he ruined something good. Things were so simple and pure and clear to him then, and he lost sight of himself or lost sight of sort of what he once thought was so admirable and good.
Hemingway was married 4 times. Pauline Pfeiffer was his second wife. But he seemed to have had a great affection for Richardson until the end of his life. Neither of them ever seemed to forget what it was like to be young and in love in Paris. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.